Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
A few days ago, I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
Apparently, this is how they retaliate when you report facts they don't like.
This White House does not seem to value an independent press. There is a word for that line of thinking. The word is un-American.
Hello, and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man who says he has a backup plan on healthcare. Let Obamacare fail and blame the Democrats. He's Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. So we're going to try something new on today's show, a book club. I have to say, almost since the first moments of Trump's candidacy in the primaries, the book I started thinking about was Philip Roth's The Plot Against America. And I had this idea in the back of my head for a long time, and I was thinking about who I could get to come talk to me about it and read it with me. I am really lucky today to have in the studio with me Katie Roifey and Philip Gurevich. Katie is a journalist, a novelist, a literary critic, a literary historian, a professor at NYU. The question is not what is she, but what is she not? I can't think of anything she doesn't do. And she's written a number of fantastic books. The most recent is called The Violet Hour, Great Writers at the End. Katie, welcome.
Thank you.
And my other guest is Philip Gurevich. He wrote a book, which if you haven't read, you absolutely have to. And it's a title that no one has been able to get out of their head since he wrote it. We wish to inform you that tomorrow we will be killed with our families. It is the most powerful book about the genocide in Rwanda. He's now writing another book having to do with Rwanda, if I'm not mistaken. Right, Philip?
Mm-hmm.
And he's a staff writer at The New Yorker. And a while back, he used to be editor of the Paris Review. Philip, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So just to get this conversation started, well, first, I think we should just, first impressions. I think we all read this book before. At least I know you did, Katie. And I know I did. But reading it again, Katie, what was your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, when I first read it, it was like a wild fantasy. And it is really eerie, I think, to go back into it because of how much the specifics kind of cohere with our reality. So it's a little startling to reread, I think. You know, and it really tells you something that it takes a novelist and a novelist of Roth's caliber to kind of imagine something that was unimaginable.
Philip, how about you? Had you read it before?
Yeah, I'd read it before. I read it when it came out and thought it was pretty amazing, but also thought it was, you know, it seemed distant, right? It was a sort of what if history of if Charles Lindbergh, great American aviation hero turned Nazi sympathizer / Nazi, leader of the American Firsters, were to sort of bump FDR out of the running as an isolationist, American first, Nazi allied candidate. And the mechanics of that seemed both brilliantly pulled off and sort of wondrously far-fetched. And as Katie says, when you read it now, I mean, there's some obviously big differences with Trump's America. Like, Trump was never a great hero to all Americans and a global hero of any kind. He was more a clown figure. And also Lindbergh's very terse, famously terse, sort of. He's this crisp, laconic type.
And but, elegant. Like
yeah,
the
I mean,
opposite.
there's a kind of, there's a huge sort of stylistic difference that matters. But there are an extraordinary number of places, I'm sure we all had these, like where you just think, how did he imagine it so precisely? You know, he was doing a what-if history of the past. But in fact, it ends up feeling like very close to a script for some of the scenarios we're in right now.
Philip Roth is famous for the observation that novelists are challenged because they keep being outdone by reality in contemporary America. And in a way, this is the ultimate illustration of his point. He went so far that he probably, when he wrote this book, thought there were elements of absurdism in what he was saying. It was illustrative, but he wasn't trying to write something predictive.
But it's incredibly grounded in historically accurate details. Everybody in the book, when he sort of lists five delegates at a Republican convention that helped nominate Lindbergh in 1940, those are real figures who would have been minor, you know, the sort of people we would know now, the senator from here and the governor from there and the guy who wanted to be on the VP ticket three times and failed. Those are all accurate. And so it's incredibly embedded also in the, as always with him, the Newark Jewish community and household that he's describing. So there's this really fine balancing act between the fantasy and, in fact, sometimes quite crazy fantasy by the end. I mean, it's aria after aria of, like, increasingly bizarre conspiracy scenarios heaped on top of each other in total confusion.
Which also seemed totally appropriate at the present moment. I want to get into the second one. Maybe, Katie, just before we kind of get full bore into it, can you just ground us a little bit in sort of what this book is about? Because I think we have a lot of people listening who haven't read it.
Just a quick plot summary. So as Philip mentioned, Charles Lindbergh, the famous and glamorous pilot, is a Nazi sympathizer. He's involved with the America First movement, and he somehow has this performance at the Republican National Convention, and he ends up in a kind of surprise victory that the day afterward, everybody is like, it's so obvious, kind of very similar to the Trump thing, is elected in 1940 instead of FDR. And he's very adamant about keeping America out of the war. So the idea is America swerving away from the war and this sort of isolationist fantasy and also the xenophobia. The novel follows the story of the Roth family living in Newark, somewhat similar to Philip Roth's actual family.
The narrator is Philip Roth.
The narrator is Philip Roth and his brother, Sandy. And what happens slowly is that it happens in a very American way, it's not Germany. The country kind of turns against the Jews. And one of the things that happens, and I won't go into every twist and turn, but there's a homesteading program run by the government in which they take Jewish children. First, they take Jewish children and send them into the heartland America to live with a family to become more American. And it has this sort of subtle kind of like taking away the Jewishness from, you know, kind of assimilating into the American culture. And then eventually they move whole families and they displace families in places like Newark. And they try to do this to the Roth family and send them to, say, a place like Kentucky to kind of make their way. And slowly the country, for various plot turns, gets very caught up in a kind of anti-Semitic violence and kind of whipped into a fantasy that the Jews are causing all these problems. And many of the friends of the Roth family, one in particular, emigrate to Canada. And the story kind of follows the drama through the eyes of this child, Philip, kind of terrified of what happens in this alternate political scenario.
Philip, as you were saying, I mean, right up until the point of Charles Lindbergh showing up at the 1940 Republican convention unexpectedly, everything is as it was historically, the real historical characters, the isolationists, the America First movement. And then this all ends sort of cataclysmically, but the real history is restored by 1943. And then we're more or less given to understand that everything else happened the way it happened. America enters the war, wins the war. Nazi Germany is defeated.
He even has a very like half sentence flash forward to the Kennedy assassination, Robert Kennedy assassination, because he one of the many plot twists is that a candidate for president gets assassinated, and Walter Winchell, in fact, who the radio personality becomes the Jewish sort of provocateur, sort of halfway between who he was and a kind of suicidal Lenny Bruce type character, sort of wandering
like
this
Colbert or something
from city to city, taunting riots into sort of try. And he actually uses a phrase in the narration where he sort of says, he'd managed to bring the Lindbergh ugly to the surface. You know, that's what he's doing in place after place. So yes, there is this restoration with a third term for Roosevelt. Basically, by
Pearl Harbor.
in time for Pearl Harbor Day. Pearl Harbor Day being, of course, December of 1942. He has, in the way that it's written, Roosevelt comes in just in time for that and is restored. But the space that he opens up inside there is extraordinary. And it is seen from this child's point of view, which is a really interesting point of view, because, of course, it's also written retrospectively. So he allows himself a tremendous sort of historical omniscience. But he also goes back to just the child's a stamp collector, which struck me because I know from several Jewish refugees from Europe who were that age at that time, who remember exactly when they lost their stamp collection in transit. So this idea that, but he also, he has this stamp collection. That's what he knows about the world. That's what he thinks is important. He thinks it's at the center of his universe. But he also starts to see these huge dynamics blowing apart between the stability of the household within the family. And one of the really striking things is the role of his brother, who very early on is sent by this bureau that Katie was referring to, the Office of American Absorption,
right.
Which basically takes teenage Jewish kids and sends them off to like work at farms.
To make real Americans out of them.
Make real Americans out of them. And he's very taken with this, much as one might be being sent off to summer camp or for an internship. And he has a great time and he like eats lots of bacon and pork chops and becomes really hale and hearty. And he loves it down there. And he is very taken with the Lindbergh phenomenon, to the horror of his father, creates a lot of conflict. And again, I remember when the book first came out, I knew somebody who had been in a kid of about that age, i.e. 10 years older than Roth, more or less, at the time that Hitler took over in Berlin, was growing up there. And he said, how did he know? He kept reading the book and he said, how did Philip Roth know how this feels? And specifically that it would be seductive to somebody who knows it's a threat. In other words, to somebody who's been told this is the greatest threat. And at the same time, the way that it tries to absorb you, the way it sort of, the pageantry of it. And this is where it's somewhat different than Trumpism, I would say, which is that it sneaks up on people. There is the idea that you were braced for a shock and the shock doesn't come. Whereas, of course, Trump sort of came in like thunder and everybody thought, whoa, we're all off kilter. And many of the things that he did that shocked, like the travel ban, if he had eased them in, we might have been slower to recognize the jolt.
Right, which is in Roth's imagining of fascism coming to America, it is stages. And of course, there are all the reassuring people who say, we're not having pogroms here yet. You know, this is America. None of this can happen here. But in stages, it does happen. That was part of the brilliance of it, was that frog being slowly boiled feeling, which some of the characters in the novel, including eventually Philip's parents, come to realize what's happening. But they're surrounded by people and by a culture that's trying to tamp down the extremity of what's happening.
Yeah, and I think there's a moment early on in that where the Roth family goes for a visit to Washington and they're very patriotic and they kind of think this is America. And there's a kind of disturbing, simmering hatred and resentment toward them as like these loud, ugly Jews that starts to come out and kind of culminates in their being kind of kicked out inexplicably from their hotel room. And his mother says something. She's like looking at the White House, I think, and she's tearing up. And she says something like, this is not a normal country. And it's the slow build, but also that feeling of dread that the parents have right from the beginning that is, I think, a little bit recognizable, especially that phrase, like, this is not normal. It's something very much that you hear people saying all the time here, you know, and it's kind of like a shock that all these ideas of America that they're confronted with so brilliantly in this sort of tour around Washington are being twisted like in front of their eyes. And some of it's by not just by the president, but by the hatred that he's pulling out of people, which is already apparent right from the beginning.
Right. I mean, it's interesting if you sort of think about Roth trying to envision what it might have been like if fascism had come to America. And it's pretty true to the experience of fascism in European countries, but transposed into an American culture and an American context. And I think a lot of the, maybe a bit of a category error people are making now is we're still thinking in those terms around Trump. We're thinking, what if 1940s European fascism came to America? And of course, that's the wrong question. The question is, what if a contemporary version of authoritarianism came to America? And one of the distinctions, of course, is around all of the symbolism and language. And really, modern authoritarianism camouflages itself as democratic. It doesn't acknowledge, it doesn't attack democracy directly in the same way. You know, so it's, I mean, I think it's, the book, it seems to me valuable for precisely that reason, that we have to use the same imaginative tools, but not to imagine the same place.
Yeah, and there's a great character in here who's this rabbi who's kind of a collaborationist with Lindbergh. And he sort of speaks to the Jews about how everything is okay. And this is really just a wonderful thing because he's going to, especially with this, you know, integration plan, he's going to kind of, you know, make them into more Americans and all these people who are alarmed or, you know, overstating. And he's sort of an apologist. And of course, bad things end up happening to him. But he's an interesting figure because he is that voice who's interpreting this and sort of kind of saying, putting it into this benign terms, like everything's fine and it happens in this sort of euphemistic and slow way that the violence becomes unavoidable.
I mean, that was, you know, I was thinking reading that of the official Russian rabbis. I mean, both the Soviet rabbis and the sort of Putin rabbis, you know, who I think part of their claim is, oh, I'm protecting the Jews by doing business with these people. And, you know, we're making things okay for ourselves.
And the rabbis who tormented and preached against and railed against and rejected Philip Roth when he came on the scene as the most important Jewish writer of the 20th century right. American life. And nevertheless, they, as the institutional American get along and go alongs, really gave him hell.
Right. Why are you embarrassing the Jews in front of the
Goyim? Yeah. You know, and in general, and just keep it low and, you know, don't say anything bad. I mean, there's something very striking about the way that he describes what the breakdown is for people and what is broken down. And over it keeps coming back to the idea that anything can now happen, that sort of a whole lot of negative potentials are unleashed. And really that's what history is. I mean, reading it, you have the sense, because he embeds it in these details of the time, and there are all these isolationists, and that the things that make the Jews in his neighborhood in Weequahic in New Jersey worried, others are cheering. And that's one of the things that keeps striking his father, that, you know, when they're in Washington, every afternoon at 5, Lindbergh comes flying over the city in a sort of like a solo air stunt, and all the people cheer. And he's like, my God, they're cheering him. You know, what strikes terror in our hearts? They're cheering. We're really far away from things now. We've been pushed out. And you realize that what Ross doing with this slight what-if history is reminding us also that, like, things that, if there's anything that when he was writing this, which was sort of, you know, not long after 9/11, but looking back at the 20th century, if there's anything that sort of had become a certainty, it was that World War II was the good war, that there was a national, you know, coming together around that, that FDR was a pretty good president. And in fact, he's reminding us that by a few flukes this way and that way, things could have gone massively the other way. And there's a passage where the characters, where little Philip comes to that realization. He says, a new life began for me. I'd watched my father fall apart, and I would never return to the same childhood. The father who defiantly serenaded all those callow cafeteria anti-Semites in Washington was crying aloud with his mouth open, crying like both a baby abandoned and a man being tortured because he was powerless to stop the unforeseen. And as Lindbergh's election couldn't have made clearer to me, the unfolding of the unforeseen was everything. Turned wrong way round, the relentless unforeseen was what we schoolchildren studied as history, harmless history, where everything unexpected in its own time is chronicled on the page as inevitable. The terror of the unforeseen is what the science of history hides, turning a disaster into an epic. It's kind of like this little moment where he zooms out and gives us, in a sense of what the big idea here really is of our time. You know, we go forward, we have some idea of what's foreseeable, we have some sense. All people want when they say we want to get on with our lives, they want to be able to predict the future. They want to kind of not have to think about the news all the time. They don't want to have to listen to the next bulletin. They don't want to be calling each other every 5 minutes to find out if they're okay. And they want to be able to foresee where they're going. And that's good times. And suddenly they're plunged into this. And of course, not the whole country, though it does escalate to where the whole country's on edge. And I think that's a really very, very deep insight also into what is so unnerving and destabilizing and moves one towards, you're in a kind of violent turmoil inside and you become acclimated to the potential for violent turmoil in general. And you know, look, what is Trump about except all these different ideas of chaos and sort of disorder and, you know, throwing people off balance and provocation for provocation's sake, unpredictability, all of that is incredibly destabilizing and unnerving both domestically and internationally.
I think also one thing is how close it is to be in this alternative reality. So like you say, how history happens. There was one line that I was very struck by, especially thinking about Trump, and I can't find it right now, but he has a line where he says, you know, we all went to sleep and half the country woke up in a dream and half the country woke up in a nightmare. And what that kind of gets at is what you're talking about, where everybody wakes up with like this crazy, we've literally stepped like Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass feeling it's a dream or a nightmare. But then that divide of like, for some people, it's like beyond their wildest expectations of how great it is that we're in this alternate reality. And then for some people, it's the worst thing that can ever happen. And how this change is so profound and it can happen in a second is so recognizable to us with Trump. Like, we think we live in this world with these like set of rules and order and principles, but then we wake up and we're not in that world. And just that feeling, which obviously we can all remember because it was, you know, a few months ago, is what he's getting at here. And it gets at how this kind of change is sort of sudden and slow. And it is like you do sometimes wake up and step into this alternate reality. And I guess that to me was one of the kind of eeriest parts of reading it, because it really felt like he's imagining something that we really literally couldn't imagine before November 8th.
Yeah, I mean, that's so interesting. And I do think it's right on point here. I mean, it's the idea of living in history, not as something exciting and momentous, but living in a condition where you lack fundamental security and where there's a quality of uncertainty about everything, including the bedrock principles and laws of the country. And that's the sort of terrifying reality Roth imagines, and that is so relevant. And I think what, you know, part of the reason this book, I think, speaks to me so much is Roth does that in a very specifically Jewish context. Mm-hmm. The book is about what if that had happened to American Jews the way it happened to European Jews during the Second World War. It's not, American Jews are not the people who are threatened right now.
No.
Not in the same way.
Not in the same way.
Although, look at all those threats to like the JCC, the graveyards being, I mean.
There's a lot of threats.
But the people who, maybe I should rephrase that. It's not that that American Jews are not vulnerable in certain ways, but that the people who are threatened in the way Jews are threatened in his book are either Muslims or immigrants from other places in the world. And the people whose residence in the country, whose legitimacy is part of the American story is being questioned are Muslims. And that's what I was reading this book. I was thinking, you know, if you change this to Muslims, change it from Jews to Muslims and change it from then to now, you have a world that maybe doesn't feel that much unlike this to people.
Although think about the Jewish thing, because there was the moment, if you remember, where the graves got turned over and Trump suggested that maybe it was the Jews behind it, you know, or that maybe it was liberals who did it. And that very much mirrors something that happened in this book, where the Jews end up getting blamed for the anti-Semitic violence, like they're staging it on purpose to kind of destabilize the country and get them into the war. So these conspiracy theories, and again, what is at stake is truth. And obviously, one of the things most unnerving to us right now is we have a president with total disregard for just saying things that are true. And I felt like that, I mean, obviously, it's definitely much more about Muslims in Trump's America, but there is this kind of idea of the story very easily turning against, like, it's the fault of the immigrant, it's the fault, you know, like, or it's the fault of the Jews that their graveyard got defaced. You know, it's like this strange story, that narrative that is being put forward that I think is in this book and so recognizable.
And again, that's a sort of trope from the Second World War, Nazism, the Reichstag fire, which, you know, for many years was generally assumed to have been set by the Nazis, you know, as a pretext for attacking Jews and seizing power in Germany. I think the historical evidence now suggests that probably it wasn't set by the Nazis. They merely capitalized it and used it as an excuse. But there is immediately going to that scenario of, whatever you were using to criticize me was probably your own provocation. Yeah, including knocking over Jewish graves in a cemetery.
Yeah.
And a president who has been absent, who has not condemned what is obviously a crisis, who has remained silent. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that's really, there's almost like an aesthetic point that towards the end you have LaGuardia, the mayor of New York, emerges as a voice, and he gives a funeral oration for Walter Winchell. And it's a fabulous sort of like defense of the messy person, you know? He's like, look, we don't, you know, he just starts right out. We can dispense with the idea that this is a likable or nice guy. Right. He's an awful, nasty, complicated person and so forth. But he then starts mocking in his speech the idea of the person who's correct and pure. Only person who always says the right thing, who's always perfectly crisp, who's always just so, is our president, Lindbergh. And then along comes Lindbergh, and we get a speech by Lindbergh that is, he goes down to Louisville, and things have been, you know, there've been riots, there've been all kinds of trouble, and it's in direct contrast to the speech that we've had from LaGuardia. And it's this very short speech. It's like five lines. And we've been told over and over, this is all he ever says. He says, there is a great war elsewhere in the world. The country is at peace. Nobody here is threatened. We are not getting entangled in their wars. They're not bringing their wars here. I'm going to go back to Washington now and make sure it's that way. That's the whole speech, basically. Five sentences, six sentences. And Roth is quietly withering about this. And what you realize is one of the things that he's setting up is that fascism is always simplicity. It's like simplicity itself erases basically everything that's interesting about human beings. Partly it's a novelist, right? He's always, and he loads things up with detail, detail, detail. Everything's grounded in its complex little tendons of connection and so forth. And this is all about lumping people into giant categories, total simplicity. And basically, anybody who's telling you it's simple is selling you a bill of goods, and a very dangerous one is what he's in a way saying.
And then the culmination of that, of course, the culmination of his being a man of few words is that he disappears, right? So his vanishing is almost the extreme articulation of how little he speaks. So it's almost like he becomes perfect.
So let's talk about what happens there, because this was the part of the book I'd forgotten, and it was both the most eerily relevant and also the most Rothian, because there's this sort of Rothian absurdist turn, and it's a little like the Anne Frank is alive and I married her, you know. but, it turns out in the conspiracy theory of the novel, there is a theory put forth at the end of the story after Lindbergh's plane has disappeared over Pennsylvania that he's been kidnapped by the Nazis, and it turns out they've been blackmailing him and his wife the whole time, and the way they've been blackmailing him is they kidnapped the Lindbergh baby. The Lindbergh baby is alive, being raised as a Hitler youth in Germany. When Lindbergh got his Nazi medal, which really happened, the true story was that they were being allowed to see their then teenage son, and this was like the compromise. This was being held over them. The Nazis were getting Lindbergh to do what they wanted to do. Wow. I mean,
but there's a step before that right. blew my mind here. Lindbergh gets elected in 1940. Within 2 weeks of his election, well before his inauguration, he flies to Iceland and meets. Does he meet Hitler directly? Yes, he meets Hitler directly and makes a non-aggression pact, a peace accord that we will remain in peaceful relations. And then he flies to Hawaii and makes the same deal with the Japanese.
Yeah.
And it's like, wait a minute, he is doing this well before he's been inaugurated.
A little Logan act.
And later on, we find out, before the conspiracy theories around the disappearance, but just before that, that some of this was already scripted. Part of the deal in Reykjavik with Hitler was that there would be this program for getting the Jews out, the Homesteading Act and the Department of Absorption and so forth. And that was already sort of, yes, we will deal with the Jewish problem in America. And so you have this idea that there was always this collusion floating through from very early on. And, again, it's imagination. But it's an amazing imagination of how the mechanism of this stuff would work with foreign influence specifically.
But there are a lot of layers here, Philip. I mean, do you think we're supposed to believe that the further conspiracy theory about Lindbergh being blackmailed is true?
No.
Or is this merely part of what floats around in the wake of this kind of catastrophe? I mean, I think
we're supposed to think that it made a lot of mischief at the time and was pretty authoritatively debunked. I mean, he seems to suggest that it's like, oh my God, everybody sort of thought for a while, you know, because people are getting swept. Like, you know, when you look at seaweed in an aquarium or something, it sort of goes this way and then it all goes that way and then it all swamps back the other way. They're getting swept by these news stories and theories. You know, one day it's that Lindbergh has actually been brought back to Germany. The next day it's that the Jews have somehow done some wild plot to kidnap him and he's being held captive by the British and Canada, and the Republicans say that they'll declare war on Canada if Canada doesn't release him, even though nobody has any evidence for any of this. And his wife is put in, the vice president takes over as president. The wife's put in the insane asylum.
And Morrow Lindbergh escapes from the insane asylum and saves
Elizabeth.
The country.
Yeah, she would have been with Ezra Pound.
But I feel like he does, the way he does it is kind of amazing because he does set up some, it's ambiguous, right? There's a possibility that it's true. And so the way he offers it up, that it's coming from this, you know, wife of the rabbi who's the sister of our, you know, Philip's mother, it's a little bit like it could be true. And again, that
was how I took it.
Yeah, that it could be. And I think the way that he sets it up so ambiguously is sort of interesting because it does get at, I mean, if we look at right now, you know, this kind of And Trump and Russia, this like desire to find a story, these like million speculations, this feeling that something's going on that we can't define, and you know all kinds of kind of fantasies at this point, and one of them may be real about what this collusion is about. And I think like just the kind of flakiness and like absurdity of this particular reason, you know, this particular kind of understanding of it. Is it just an interesting articulation of all these kind of conspiracy theories and also this feeling that how is it possible that somebody would like betray the country as our president? You know, it's just like impossible. It's unthinkable. And so how do we think it?
Well, that's where a lot of these conspiracies, I think what's happening at the end with all is also that. It's that there's something, we need an explanation. Like there's too much that's unexplained that doesn't make sense here that just happened. I mean, we know it happened.
Right.
But we don't know what happened. And I think there's a bit of that feeling around this Russia stuff now. I mean, the line you mentioned to Philip Ross earlier, this famous line in 1960, he wrote this essay about the difficulty of being an American novelist today. That was 1960. And he says that the American writer in the middle of the 20th century has his hands full in trying to understand, describe, and then make credible, right? Because that's the problem. You don't just have to describe it. You actually have to make it seem like this makes sense somehow. Much of American reality. It stupefies. It sickens. It infuriates. And finally, it is even a kind of embarrassment to one's own meager imagination. The actuality is continually outdoing our talents, and the culture tosses up figures almost daily that are the envy of any novelist. Well, this is the book where he laid that one to rest. You know, he really outdid. And it does have this rip from the headlines feeling by the end where he seems to be just digesting days of wild reporting that have come over the airwaves and different theories. But there's that need to sort of make what happened credible.
Yeah. And
that also makes people vulnerable to these theories.
Yeah. And I also think there's an American public, as you're saying, that needs to explain its own account. You know, how did they, why were they complicit? So why did we fall for this? There has to be a story, and it's almost like so crude. It's like a New York Post story, you know, that's so cartoonish. There has to be a story to explain it, because otherwise we have to confront the really ugly things inside the individual Americans that let this happen. And so I think that in a way that hunger or that desire for that story always exists, because it's like there's this reason that this thing happened to us. And that reason isn't because we are, you know, of the moral ambiguity of your average American.
Right. Well, the opponents gravitate to it. And this is true in the Trump moment, because it's the worst you can think of someone who is really terrible. Right. And could he have conspired with Russia? Could his campaign have conspired with Russia? People who go, like me, who go through lives not believing things like that kind of thing.
Want to believe it. Yeah.
I wouldn't put it past him.
Right.
You know, and there is evidence we've got to look at, and he's preventing anybody from investigating it. You know, but in another moment, you think, well, Is it? Do you think it's likely that it's true? Not that likely. Probably not. You know, and that's a little bit where we end up with the conspiracy thinking at the end of Plot Against America.
I do think that there's a Rothian resistance, as I said earlier, to the simplicity, that anything that ties up too neatly is not really credible,
right?
That the world is, and I think that's sort of true with the Trump thing. The idea that we're going to come up with a perfect conspiracy that shows collusion between the campaign and the Russians that coordinated everything just so seems incredibly unlikely. The idea that there were messy, complicated links and ties, that the Russians were trying to influence things, that the campaign was trying to see how to work that, that there may have some compromise here and some this and that. We don't know. We don't really know what the game is. There's certainly every appearance of a cover-up without a clear sense of what's being covered up.
Right.
But here, with World War II, it was a little more obvious what was going on until it becomes like the mysterious disappearance.
Yeah. But the more complicated story is, hey, it's not that our authoritarian, they're being manipulated by foreigners. It's that we have our own authoritarians and they happen to really sympathize with Putin and Russia. It's what they think. It's not because of the hotel he wants to build in Moscow. I mean, maybe because he wanted to build a hotel in Moscow, he got friendly with a lot of Russians, and that helped to convince him that they were right about Ukraine. But it's a way of not taking them at face value, and as Katie was saying, not acknowledging the kind of negative capability in our own democratic system.
Yes, and I think it just deflects attention, these stories or these accounts, from something much more complicated and much more ominous that is going on, which is the kind of embrace within, and I don't mean just Trump, but like the embrace of even many people in this country of this kind of authoritarian mode.
One more point I wanted to touch on, because it just sort of made me think reading it again. America first. So we have in the White House right now a president who is totally ignorant of history, but his top guy, Steve Bannon, knows a lot about history, albeit in a very skewed way.
He reads
history books. Trump thinks America first is a great phrase because he doesn't know that it was the slogan of American fascism.
He knows by now, I guess. And now he likes that. He doesn't care.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe
he likes that. I think that somebody tells him and he's like, so that upsets a bunch of people who are upset with me anyway. Let them wriggle. I mean, I think I do think also here, you know, you have this strange sense that this occurs in a context where there is an international parallel. That's all. That's where the Russia stuff kind of comes into play.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be this perfect story, but like, it's the same thing. He says he's trying to make peace and avoid being in conflict with people that many people think, well, we're in conflict with them.
Right.
They're an adversary and their interests are not ours. But I think that he knows what it means by now.
And I guess he's vindicated in the sense that nobody particular seems to mind. I mean, it feels like almost a pedantic point to say this was an American fascist slogan. And of course, American fascism is, contrary to the fantasy of the book, such a weird sort of footnote to history. And the silver shirts, the American fascists all sort of got on board with the war effort. And it was a little embarrassing detail in their young biographies when they were at Yale Law School or whatever. But it didn't do enough damage for it to be a psychic scar. So it's just a phrase. He's right.
Yeah. And also, by the way, it's a very charismatic phrase and a very effective phrase. And it was then and it is now. So part of Trump is going to just go for like the ratings, you know, like, does it work? Does it sell? And it does still. And it did then to a certain extent.
But it is also hitting the same notes. I think it's very important because you have the white nationalism. I mean, Bannon reads history, but he also reads there was this piece recently in the Huffington Post about this vile French book by Jean Raspail called Camp of Saints, which is just this, you know, total dystopian fantasy of the dark people coming and invading the white people's
destroying
planets and must be exterminated. And I mean, he's deep into, he's a Nazi sympathizer, if not a flat out Nazi, Bannon. I think it's pretty clear by now that ideologically his sympathies are aligned with the hard, hard, ultra extremist white nationalist right across Europe with these traditions. And these traditions are American. We may have thought they were basically deeply dormant, that they were like a tiny fringe that was afraid to be seen. But he, by attaching to Trump, and he's sometimes described himself as sort of, you know, Trump is like the vehicle he will ride as far as he can ride it, creates a situation where these things come alive again. And there's a paperback of the plot against America has a bunch of historical references at the back and a little bit of, and it has a quote. The very last thing in the postscript is a quote from A. Scott Berg's biography of Lindbergh. And it says, peace, Lindbergh felt, could exist only as long as, quote, we band together to preserve that most priceless possession, our inheritance of European blood, only so long as we guard ourselves against attack by foreign armies and dilution by foreign races. And then he goes further. He wrote that it also depended on, quote, a united strength among ourselves, on a strength too great for foreign armies to challenge, on a Western wall of race and arms, which can hold back either a Genghis Khan or an infiltration of inferior blood. Okay, this is a little bit more explicitly, you know, there are a few words that you'd edit before it became a Trump speech, but not much.
That's Bannonism right there.
That's Bannonism in a nutshell, and Bannonism is the closest thing that that Trump has come to embracing an ideology.
But and also the similarity of protecting America, so the idea that you're protecting, and also that it's peace. So the idea that actually this incredibly mean and vicious ethic is about protecting our own and about keeping peace rather than, you know, entering into war or protecting us from, like, you know, terrorism now, obviously. But the kind of benign nature, it's like a phrase with a benign mask over it. And it operates in this similar, really complicated way. And I think you're so right, Philip, to say there's something in America, you know, Philip Roth's father is always like, but this is not America. You know, America's not about this. But I think what you're pointing out is like, America is about this, and it always has been. And so this ugliness that we're sort of saying is other and is not what our, it's a perversion of America. It's a perversion of the idea of America. It is and it isn't. And it was always there all along. And that's the ambiguity in this book, where Philip Roth's father, who's such an idealist, who loves America, who's such a patriot, is wrong, kind of. And that's one of the things that's sort of heartbreaking in this book, to see his disillusionment and to see how that works. And to me, that was like one of the kind of excruciating parts about reading. It's very, we haven't really said this yet, but it's a very hard book to read.
Yeah.
Today, I think, especially. But it's also painful, even when you read it like back in 2004 or whatever. It's a very painful book because it really comes up against these incredibly difficult ideas.
Well, and because it's so real and so vivid, and I think that goes back to the point about it being told through the eyes of a child as an adult, you know, just the terror that a 9-year-old feels in that uncertainty and all of the things that he blames himself for that are beyond his control and all the family dynamics. I agree, it's an excruciating book. It's also a thrilling book, though. Yeah. I mean, of Roth's novels, I find this just the hardest to put down, even just reading it the second time and kind of already knowing what happens. It's a crazy page turner.
Well, he, you know, there is another little place where he touches on that, like the deep strain of Bannonism, where there, I forget exactly where in here, but early in Lindbergh's run, there's a direct juxtaposition of him with the symbolism of the old Confederacy.
Yeah.
And you know, which we see again with Sessions or whoever, but, you know, this has been here for a long time. This is a deep strain in America. And by the way, American literature is not shy about that. You know, you read mm-hmm. you read the Sinclair Lewis, you read the Upton Sinclair, but you read, you know, Robert Stone in the 60s. You read a lot of people who are writing where this stuff is always burbling, this kind of white nationalist kind of, it's not coherent always. It doesn't always have nice uniforms like it does by when it really gets up and running, but it's always there. And Roth calls it in American Pastoral, he has that line. He just calls it the indigenous American berserk.
That is a great phrase. Yeah. I also just want to point out one thing that's so brilliant about this book is that it's as you said about resisting simplicity. When Sandy goes to visit the family in Kentucky, you sort of think that that family is going to turn out to be anti-Semitic and they're going to be horrible. But in the end, they step in and save, they help this orphaned Jewish child in the middle of Kentucky, and they drive and they take him and they turn out to be good people. And Sandy's like, look, I was right. They were good. And one of the things that I love about that moment is that part of what makes this book so persuasive is that he doesn't fall into the simplifying that, by the way, has been the error of American journalism, has been a problem in our culture, that it's, you know, middle America is not all bad, that there are good people and bad people, and that there's decency and there's, you know, and so his ability to kind of convey like a Walt Whitman, you know, the multitudes of Walt Whitman in this novel are part of what make it so persuasive and so convincing as a narrative, because it isn't one thing. And he's not going for that, you know, America's, you know, just the way you can hear like a history class to an eighth grader right now talk about race in America or, you know, all of that. It's like not simple in Roth.
That's a flip side. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's also the Italian neighbors, right?
Right, the Italian neighbors are amazing.
Like, immediately, instinctively, like, you know, it's terrible, we'll these fascists. Here, let me give you a gun, you know? And at first, they're scared silly because these, you know, the Jews have been moved out of the building. These Christian, Italian workmen have been moved in downstairs and seem like, you know, the sort of people who they're supposed to be afraid of ancestrally almost. And instead, they like, you know, immediately exactly. like, well, we're in the same fight here. Yeah. And so that comes through, and it's the flip side of the fact that, of course, the collaborationists that we see most explicitly are Jews. Yeah. So the Jews aren't exactly like a tidy packet. No group is
right. And Walter
immune.
Winchell is this kind of crummy right. guy, but who ends up being the guy who stands up for the basic principles.
Right.
And I think when you use the word thrilling earlier, Jacob, I just feel like part of what was thrilling is that there is kind of a humanity. So one of the things that kind of it's not what pulls them back from the brink of this hideousness. But there is this humanity, and there is the kind of like impulse to protect, and there are good people. And it's not like it's sort of, you know, I think that makes it not as dark, but also that's part of what's thrilling about it is like the pullback from the brink. And you really are relieved when we get to Pearl Harbor and enter the war and like, you know, everything turns out okay.
Yeah. So, well, we should wrap up here. But just as a last thought, what do you imagine Philip Roth thinks looking at what's going on in Trump's America, especially in reference to this? I mean, as you quoted, Philip, that essay we both love, he's been involved in this duel with reality since 1960, where he tries to get the better of it, and it ends up getting the better of him. Do you think he feels that way? Do you think he feels like he couldn't out-imagine American reality in the end?
I ran into him in December of the year before last, so in 2015, in other words, when Trump was just really getting up and running, right? And it was just at a holiday gathering somewhere where there were a lot of people, and he said, you know, he knows I like to read the newspapers. So he's like, you know, what is going on? And I said, you tell me, you wrote the script. And he was just like, ha, 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 ha. It's mad. Yeah. I mean, I think, of course, it was dawning on him that like this was, but to him, it was all real and possible. I think that's part of it, is that you have to shut off your imagination to think it's not. And that it's always a mistake to think it's not possible, that all these potentials are ricocheting around out there. And it's a very narrow line often between order and disorder.
I think from a literary point of view, though, Trump is not a Roth character. He's too clownish to be a Roth character. I think he's more of an Amos character or a Bellow character.
I was going
to
say, yeah.
Like Bellow or Amos. Yeah. He is not someone that would have come out of Roth's imagination somehow.
He's in here. Alvin, the cousin, early in the book, works for a Jewish developer.
Yep.
That guy is Trump.
That guy is Trump.
Yeah. He's like, he's a chis. He actually, every time a bill comes in,
right, he won't pay his
he's
bills.
Like, I'm paying you 40%. Yeah. I don't have any money.
Oh, yeah.
He lives in a tower he built with all of his sons who have to work for him, and he yells at them all day long.
Oh, yeah, you're
he
right.
gives parties where he doesn't talk to anybody. Nobody thinks he has any friends. It's an amazing.
Yeah, you got it,
Philip. Right. That one
absolutely.
Is Trump. I know. That one is like, Trump.
And it's a side character. He's a guy who comes and goes in four or five pages. But Roth, I mean, part of when you say it's thrilling, I think part of it is just the sheer verbal and imaginative energy and the energy of this. Yeah. They're long sentences. Some of these paragraphs are like run-on sentences where it just gallops through a ton of just information and observation and kind of passionate
right.
interest in American people and lives and the texture and the mechanics of life, how people work, what they do, and that how all this comes out of it and feeds into it. And, it, you know, the political world is born of that and creates that, but also is a part. And he's amazingly weaving all of that. And part of it is just seeing somebody put it all together.
And it's amazing. If you read any sentence in this book, it's so simple.
Yeah.
His observations are so direct. He makes you, you read Philip Roth and you almost think anybody could do that.
Yeah.
But of course, nobody else
He's
can.
He's very, also, very clean exposition.
I just want to end with this one idea, which is I just feel like for everybody who's like obsessively searching their phone and reading like Politico and Talking Points Memo and The Washington Post and trying to understand like our political world, like put away your phone and read this book. Because I really feel like we need novelists to explain this moment more than we need the kind of quick news that we're used to obsessively following. Not that we don't need to follow that too. But I just do feel like I felt like I got more out of understanding this moment from this novel than I did from my, and I admit to, obsessive Trump news following.
Katie, I couldn't agree with you more. And I should just say it's a good moment to mention. We have a Facebook page for TrumpCast. And if you have read Plot Against America, you're reading it, please share your thoughts. We'd love to know what you think about it. I really want to thank you guys. Katie, Philip, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Oh, great.
Thanks so much.
That's it for today's show. TrumpCast is produced by Jason DeLeon. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and Andy Bowers is Panoply's chief content officer. John DiDomenico is our voice of the Donald Trump. And hey, did you like today's show? Do you want to hear more of them? Well, you can leave us a note or send us a message on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us at facebook.com/RealTrumpCast or on Twitter at RealTrumpCast. And while you're commenting, why don't you take a few seconds to recommend one of your favorite shows to a friend using the hashtag TryPod. That's hashtag T-R-Y pod. You can mention TrumpCast if you want. That would be good. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks for listening to TrumpCast.